Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 18th of January 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. I'll also say we've got an off-camera guest, a supporter of UK Column, and indeed the British Constitution Group, who's come down to Plymouth to visit us today. So we'll welcome that gentleman who's in us with us, who is with us in the studio at the moment. Where do we begin? Fake news.
Fake news, yes. The mainstream media going nuts because Donald Trump has published his, as he describes it, highly anticipated 2017 fake news awards. We'll just run through these because they are pretty good. He starts off with the New York Times. Paul Krugman claimed on the day of his victory that the economy would never recover. ABC News, Brian Ross sends the markets in a downward spiral with a false report. CNN falsely reported that Donald Trump and his son Donald J. Trump Jr. had accessed hacked documents from WikiLeaks. He mentions Time falsely reporting that Trump had removed the bust of Martin Luther King Jr. from the Oval Office. The Washington Post falsely reporting that Trump had sold out, that his massively sold-out rally in Pensacola was empty. CNN falsely editing a video to make it appear that Trump had overfed fish during a visit with the Japanese Prime Minister. CNN falsely reporting that Anthony Scaramucci's meeting with Russian with a Russian, but retracted it due to significant breakdown in process. Newsweek falsely reporting that Polish First Lady did not shake hands with President Trump. CNN again reporting that former FBI Director James Comey would dispute Trump's claim that he was told he was not under investigation. The New York Times falsely claiming on the front page that Trump administration had hidden a climate report. And last but not least, he says Russia collusion, and he's saying there is no Russia collusion. So this, of course, has had the mainstream press in a tizzy today, Brian. BBC Radio 4 Today programme trying to justify their actions by, in a soft way, criticising some of the other mainstream coverage of Donald Trump and suggesting that perhaps their direct criticism wasn't really appropriate, as opposed to the BBC Today's programme's little snide comments, side comments that they make, which bring you to the same conclusion. So the hypocrisy throughout the mainstream media, absolutely amazing, once again.
Amazing, and this is the same mainstream media that is going overseas and training young journalists to report accurate journalism in trouble spots, so into Palestine, into Syria, into Afghanistan. So that system of journalism and media training these young people in those sorts of standards. Pretty impressive stuff.
Yes, and of course the other target for much of the mainstream's fake news agenda is the Russians, and this is Maria Zakharova, the Russian Foreign Ministry Facebook page, commenting on this article from a German website, a German media outlet, and she says, analysing fake news about Russia is one of my routine responsibilities. Statements made by Russian officials are often distorted beyond recognition. We're used to this. But Stefan Scholl from Sudvest Pressa has gone further than many, if not all, in an article entitled Russia, a Big Settlement of Accounts with the US. She says that he claims that Sergei Lavrov said something that he didn't say. The journalist had said that Lavrov presented a peaceful protest by pro-Ukrainian Tatars in March 2014 as an attack by Islamic extremists on the Crimean parliament. And then she goes on to correct that situation. But it does beg the question, when is the mainstream media going to grow up a little bit with regard to the standard of reporting of people that, for whatever reason, they've taken a dislike to?
I think the answer to that, Mike, is when they're held to account by the readers and the people who watch these reports. So the onus comes back onto us. We've got to hold them to account. I understand that Facebook is going to make a final decision, or it's going to do the final investigation as to whether the Russians were in interfering with social media. So we've seen a large number of reports where newspapers, BBC and the other big American TV companies are all saying, yes, the Russians did hack. We've still seen no evidence. Facebook, that was all a done deal. I thought that they'd prove that the Russians were in there, but apparently not. They are going to come to a final conclusion.
Yeah, but isn't that with regard to Brexit specifically? Or is that broader than that?
Well, I think it's broader than that, Mike, as with all these things, it's a bit vague. We've often said that a UK column news is a very important one for the material that we've covered. We think today we are covering some outstanding material, and we're going to encourage all of our viewers and listeners to help circulate this. What we're going to talk about is really taking place under the smokescreen of what we're led to believe is normality in British politics. So I've just chosen this as an example. We've got the Parliament website, www.parliament.uk, advertising that the government's Brexit position paper, Foreign Policy, Defence and Development, a future partnership paper inquiry. They're talking about submissions and deadlines. This is an utter smokescreen, because we are now going to take a look under the surface of what is really happening to form British politics. And this is nothing to do with democracy, nor is it to do with debate in Westminster.
Indeed. So taking place today is the UK-France summit. This is taking place at Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. Theresa May and President Macron meeting. And it's going to be attended by UK cabinet ministers, their counterparts. It's Macron's first visit to the UK as president. It's also going to be attended by the heads of the five intelligence services from the UK and France, and they're going to discuss efforts apparently to tackle terrorism. I wonder, is it Islamic terrorism they're going to talk about? Because just a couple of days ago, of course, it was discovered that the French intelligence services had been doctoring files to cover up their failings that resulted in, if you remember, the priest that was killed in the church recently. Are they going to be discussing Islamic terrorism, or are they going to be discussing domestic terrorism, or is it going to be a case of both? And then Theresa May, of course, is also expected to announce £44.5 million of funding for tightening security against illegal immigration. That funding is going to go towards security fencing, some CCTV, and it's going to be at Calais and other ports along the Channel. It has been discussed in various mainstream press that Macron is attempting to overhaul the Treaty of Le Turquet, which is the treaty which puts French personnel in Britain and British personnel in France, so effectively moves the borders across the Channel. But the question is, Brian, are there going to be any borders between France and Britain in the not-too-distant future? I think that's something that is on the cards as we go through this process.
I'll just say on screen at the moment, that's quite an interesting statement, isn't it? The UK and France will continue to work together. Nothing has changed. Life goes on.
Absolutely. But of course, it's not just about counter-terrorism and immigration. It's also about defence. And so the Ministry of Defence has a nice little video here talking about this, because Britain is continuing to increase its defence cooperation with the French. This time they are going to give five Chinook helicopters so that France can deal with its operation in Mali, and France is going to take part in the UK-led NATO battle group in Estonia. We're working ever closer together following the Lancaster House treaties in 2010, so that continues to develop. But it was a bit confusing, Brian, as to what the name of this particular summit was. It is the UK-France summit. But here we've got Andrew Adonis tweeting out earlier on, President Macron here on Thursday at Sandhurst for Franco-British Council. Now, of course, the Lancaster House treaties came out of we've described it as treason, surrounding the Franco-British Council, the organisation, and their facilitation of the discussions which brought about those treaties and the merging, or the effective merging, of French and British military capabilities in many ways. But in fact, this is not a Franco-British Council event. That is taking place in March, when the 2018 Franco-British Defence Conference will take place at the French Embassy in London. So once again, we're having a behind closed doors, invitation only meeting in an embassy with goodness knows what outcome. But perhaps we're going to shed some light on that.
Well, I hope we are, Mike, because if it wasn't for the UK column, there would be no light at all on what the Franco-British Council has been doing. Remember, this is a charity. We're going to come into to have a look at it in some detail, but it's another charity which is highly active in high-level political discussions. So that's a bit of an oxymoron, because charities shouldn't be politically motivated. That's part of the rules on charities, except when they're charities, of course, funded by the British government. So where are we going to come in? This is where it's got very confusing. This is a tweet from the Franco-British Council itself saying, setting up the scene for tomorrow's UK-France summit. So when you read this, is this a bit of a play on people's minds to make you think that the Franco-British Council has set it up? Or did the Franco-British Council set it up as it has done previous big talks, but it's not declaring that to the public? We don't know, but it's an interesting tweet. Let's have a look at some of the detail on the Franco-British Council. It's independent, Mike. It is an independent organisation based in Paris and London, and its mission is to reflect the wide relationships between the two nations and promote constructive dialogue for enhanced future collaboration. So we've got Brexit. We're leaving the European Union control, and France, of course, is the European Union. It's fully embedded in the European Union. But here they are calmly saying, well, you British think you're coming out, but actually you're going to be locked into future collaboration. And then we see that the council was funded in 1972, joint initiative, President Georges Pompidou and Prime Minister Edward Heath, a man with a really astonishing track record. Child abuse is probably the least of it. But what were they looking at doing back in 72? Not creating a common market, the context of developing Europe and of an increasingly globalised community. So all of this, the EU super state, was clearly well known back in 1972. And here were these two men putting together this structure, which, as it says in the final sentence there, was going to lead representatives of the worlds of culture, politics, defence, science, education and business. So this is full integration of everything with the French. And if we go to the Franco-British Council's website, we find more statements. We promote constructive dialogue between France and the UK. And here's the word enhanced future collaboration. So we're told we're breaking away from the EU, but actually we're being locked in even tighter to the EU structure via these treaties with the French. No discussion about this in the mainstream press or media. No discussion about this from UKIP's leader, Nigel Farage. A wall of silence. This is really the structure taking the country apart. And if we have a look at a little bit of detail to show it to you, we've had to go to video because there's so much information, but you can go to the Franco-British Council website yourself to have a look. Let's see what's on this page. We promote constructive dialogue between France and the UK for the enhanced future collaboration. So this will, or it should do, scroll up and show us some of the people concerned. We haven't got time in today's news to give you all of this detail, but you can have a look at this for yourself. And it's really quite astonishing the number of people who are committed to this, not just in matters of politics and defence, but across energy, industry, education. This is a complete merging, Mike, of the societies of these two countries. This is what I think I get out from these people. So it goes on. And as we're going to see in a minute, we've got training of people happening, which is very much like common purpose. But go to the website yourself and have a look at these people and ask who they really are. Some of them are military. Some of them are British military. Who are they? Who appointed them? Who have voted for them? Is there any democracy in this? I think this is Tony Blair's appointed new leaders, yeah, which he talked about in a policy document back in 2010 himself. So page after page of these individuals. Let's go to this one, because the Franco-British Council is also setting up a young leaders program. And the moment I saw this, Mike, I thought to myself, well, this has got to be in line with common purpose training. This is taking people through fast streaming of political ideology. You will see all of the young lovelies here coming up. There's a military man in the middle from UK. And when we get down to the bottom, we should see a gentleman who's connected in with directly connected with Theresa May. He's providing political guidance for her. We're just coming up to it now. There he is, Stephen Parkinson. We'll come on to him in just a second. So this is not just a charity in the standard form, Mike. We're now seeing the style of common purpose, the style of these specially chosen, trained, promoted new leaders in every subject. Mm. Now, to get some information on the gentleman connected next to Theresa May, I went to Conservative Home, encourage people to go and have a look at this website, because they're really spilling the beans on the political machinery of the Tory party. And if this one scrolls through, which hopefully it will, we'll see that you can go to this website and have a look at that man himself. So this is information on the political team which advises Theresa May. So this is nothing to do with getting out there and helping the population on the ground. This is all to do with political manipulation around the Prime Minister herself. And these people are all specialists. They all come from quasi-political commercial backgrounds. And I'd say, if you've never seen this level of advisor before, please go to that stage and check it through yourself. There's a lot of information there. Here's the Franco-British Local Leaders Programme. I'm not going to give you any detail on that, but to say that we have the high-level political leaders, these are really lower level. This is students on the street, Mike. This is choosing people to help press the political agenda at a very local community level. And when I've looked at the detail here, this seems to fit in very much with David Cameron's Big Society talk, where he has said that thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people would be recruited and trained to be leaders within Big Society. So this is really quite amazing stuff. This is some more comment from one of the British Council documents. This is the 2017 one on defence. And if we come into this paragraph here, we'll do it very quickly. Following up on the subjects discussed in 2015 and taking into account subsequent developments, the conference included four roundtables which respectively dealt with the political impetus of bilateral security cooperation after Brexit, prospects for a shared defence culture in respect of Europe and NATO, the setting up of mutual dependency in industrial domains of sovereignty, added value of the partnership to combat terrorism and put in place scenarios in which the joint expeditionary force could be used. I'm just going to bring in the highlight of this phrase, because we've been advised that the setting up of mutual dependency in industrial domains of sovereignty is a coded reference to strategic nuclear weapons. And of course, part of Cameron's treaties with the French is that the British and French strategic nuclear deterrent was to be merged. And the start of that has been done through the processing of fissionable material.
So that was roundtables in 2015. And here we are in start of 2018. And two of the items there, the value of the partnership to combat terrorism, that's one. And to put in place a scenario where the joint expeditionary force would be used, those are both on the agenda for this meeting today.
Yeah, because this document, which you can get off the Franco-British website, I encourage people to download it. And if you read it, it's like looking at the roadmap for how Britain is going to be locked into the European Union post-Brexit. It is astonishing, the detail. And remember that this whole event is not facilitated by the British government itself. This is put together by a charity. So we've now got defence, we've got sovereignty issues being run by a charity. If we just put a little of this together in a diagram, the great lie at the very beginning is that the Franco-British Council is independent. This is completely untrue because it's paid for by the British and French governments and the British and French defence ministries in particular. There are other donors. We'll have a look at those in just a second. Let's remind ourselves that this was set up with Ted Heath. My question is, was Ted Heath being controlled when he took us into the EU? Was he being blackmailed over the abuse of children? We're still waiting for Britain's police and the Conservative Party to give us the answer. You've mentioned terrorism and extremism, Mike. I was fascinated to see that there's an input to the trustees of the Franco-British Council from the Quilliam organisation, which boasts it's the world's first anti-extremism organisation. So that organisation needs some watching. Here's the document that I've just quoted from. This is the defence document they've put out. Have a read of this document because it's a blueprint for the destruction of UK in this enhanced future collaboration. And we'll say at the top of the screen there that, of course, it was the UK Columns exposure back in 2010-11 that first put the highlight on this. So those other funders, Mike.
Yes, yeah, so the other funders, have we got the City of London? There's a whole bunch of corporate funders from the City of London to EDF to Société Générale and people like that. Then we've got some institutional funders, including, as you said, the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office and the French equivalents. And then in the centre there, we've got two private donors, Joseph Uguruyan, I can't even pronounce his name, Uguruyan, who is, he is, sorry, founder of Amber Capital. And the sole portfolio manager of both the Amber Global Opportunities Fund and the Amber Active Investors Fund. He founded Amber Capital in 2005.
So this is hedge funds?
Absolute hedge fund
hedge
money.
Hedge funds, right.
He's a graduate of the HEC Business School in Paris, and he's also a graduate of the Sorbonne. So this is the type of person that has been, but he's based in London because he's married to British person, so there's a Franco-British connection
there.
Yeah, and also Jean-Luc Alavena, who's partner of Apollo Global Management LLC and Apollo Management International LLC, so more hedge fund money. He also served as Chief of Staff to Prince Albert II of Monaco from 2005 to 2006, and he was selected as a young leader of the French-American Foundation, so whether that's a precursor to the Young Leaders Program of the Franco-British Council, I'm not certain. So lots of corporate money, lots of hedge fund money, and lots of government money going into this organisation. So this, again, demonstrates links between the corporate side and the government side pushing policy.
And you see that if you go and have a look at the trustees, because you can find people connected with energy, with very large water companies. Everything is in there, but these people are not elected. But as we can see, they're forming policy.
But we don't have to worry, Brian, because Nigel Farage says the most important thing is that we're paying £45 million towards the border security in Calais and taking more immigrants, and Mrs. May is weak.
Yeah. So all of this evidence, Mike, which has been pushed out by the UK column for a very large number of years, much of it was put straight into the heart of UKIP, where I'm very pleased to say many people picked up on it. But Nigel Farage can't or won't see what's happening in the country, won't talk about the important issues. You could say it's ignorance. I'm beginning to think it isn't. I think this is calculated because what is he achieving at the moment? Well, let's go to Russia today, because it's Russia today that's picking up on it. William Hague says that UKIP is irrelevant and should disband. This is part of the thing. UKIP should do the dignified thing and disband, he said, as the party plunges into a fresh crisis over the leader's racist ex-girlfriend. So this is where UKIP has been brought to, surprisingly, just at the critical moment where we can see the evidence for UK's sovereignty, its condition as a nation state being taken apart. Just at that important moment, UKIP is put into utter chaos, its reputation ruined by the new leader, and of course it's not active. So William Hague says, well, we might as well scrap it. It's pretty obvious, Mike.
Yeah. Okay, moving on then. The National Audit Office has released a report on PFI, Public Finance Initiative, and also PF2, which is the successor. They're saying that they're increasing pressure on the private sector in the wake of the Carillion collapse. They say that this report presents information on the rationale, costs and benefits of the Private Finance Initiative and the use and impact of Private Finance Initiative and ability to make savings from operational contracts and the introduction of PF2. There are currently over 700 operational PFI and PF2 contracts with a capital value of around £60 billion. Annual charges for these deals amount to £10.3 billion in 2016-2017. And they say that even if no new deals are entered into, future charges will continue until the 2040s and will amount to £199 billion. So just to put this, say this again, the capital value of the infrastructure that's been built as a result of PFI and PF2, £60 billion. And over the next 20 years or so, we're going to be paying £199 billion on top of that. Is that considered good value for money?
Well, of course it isn't, Mike. And the other thing that goes with it is if we take NHS, we take hospital PFIs, and the pattern is similar in other places, but just take that example, that at the end of the PFI deal, the public is handed back the rotting infrastructure and they still have the debt to pay on top of it. So those companies, having milked the profit out of the system, then hand us back the residue, the remnants of the hospital buildings and infrastructure, and says, well, you can have that lot back. They're still getting their money. So this is effectively rape of the nation's infrastructure. And these very people are the people being brought into the Franco-British Council in order to set up the structure for our future defence and sovereignty agreements with the French. This is treason.
So I'm going to highlight two articles from the UK Column website, one from 2010, Plundering State Assets with Public-Private Partnerships, and also from 2016, International Public Procurement Rules Lay Bare the Lies of Brexit. So please go and read those articles to get a bit of further context on this. Now, Royal Bank of Scotland is in trouble. This is an internal memo which Royal Bank of Scotland staff were sent. And the memo was talking about struggling small companies, many of which had been hurt by the financial crisis in 2007-2008, described these companies as basket cases, and staff were advised that missed opportunities with regard to these companies will mean missed bonuses. There was a subsection in the memo which was headed up with the word rope, employees were told that sometimes you need to let customers hang themselves. That's delightful. Yes, not much to say about that.
No.
So this has been criticised widely, MPs criticising it, all kinds of criticising it. But I just remind everybody to hunt out the discussion that Brian had with Colm Canning, a former senior manager at Ulster Bank, of course, Ulster Bank owned by RBS. Colm Canning had resigned from the bank when he was asked to apply policies similar to those being described in the memo. To businesses, he was uncomfortable with them, and those policies, he said, had resulted in otherwise viable businesses being asset stripped and liquidated, all in the dash for cash at the bank.
And of course, what happened to him? He was hounded out of his job. He's eventually put through the courts. He has massive attacks on his family life. His children were brought into it, all because he spoke out and told the truth. And I think I'd just like to add to that, this is a prime example of when people do have the courage to whistleblow, wherever they come from, then they need the support of the British public to get behind them, to reinforce what they're saying, protect them, and of course get other whistleblowers to join them.
Good news, Brian, because the wonderful David Gough, the Right Honourable David Gough, has been sworn in this morning as Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice. David Gough, I have been in communication with in the past because in an earlier part of my life he was my MP, and highly impressed I was with him as well. And I hope you appreciate the sarcasm in that. This is what he said in his swearing-in speech this morning. He said, "Mr. Attorney, I'd like to thank the Lord Chief Justice for that warm welcome, and I look forward to working with you and other members of the bench. I'd also like to start by thanking my predecessors and the Cabinet colleague, David Lidington, who I think quickly established himself as an effective Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State. I very much hope to simulate his speedy grasp of such an important constitutional role." He said, "Defending the independence of the judiciary and respecting the rule of law, that is the foundation of our democracy, our way of life, and the safeguard of fairness and freedom in our society." I think perhaps there's a few people in Parliament need to be reintroduced to the concept of the rule of law, but anyway, we'll move on. He said, "You, the judiciary, are at the heart of the rule of law. You uphold and exercise that every day in the judgments and decisions you make, and in being called upon to make decisions on some of the most difficult moral and technical issues of our time." No mention of juries in this speech, Brian. In fact, many people would argue that juries are the heart of the rule of law, and that it's juries that make decisions on what's right and wrong. But anyway, we move on. It also means a justice system that supports victims and ensures... supports victims and ensures a smooth and efficient process for litigants, for example, through new technology and greater innovation. I look forward to working closely with the Lord Chief Justice and senior judiciary to build on the important work that's already underway to reform and modernise our courts and tribunal system and make this a reality. Now, what he's talking about here, of course, is all the technological changes that are being brought in, initiated by Lord Leveson. Where does it take us? It takes us to the point where people don't need to go into court. Of course, courts will be moved online.
Yeah.
There's no transparency, no seeing justice being done in many cases.
Well, of course, Melanie Shaw's had this precise problem that once she was incarcerated in prison, when new hearings came up, she wasn't actually taken out of prison and taken to the courts. She was sat on a video link which mysteriously always broke down or was shut off at the time that Melanie Shaw started to speak out in her own defence. And this, of course, is one of the remarkable things about this lady, that she is very capable of speaking in her own defence when she's given the opportunity. But under the new Skype court arrangements, that could clearly be turned off or turned at the flick of a switch or the press of a button, and this will happen to other people. So the IT is overtaking particularly the use of proper court records and the opportunity for justice to be seen and heard to be done. Dangerous stuff.
Yeah. Slightly less serious, but we just thought we'd highlight it. A couple of people in the UK column forums pointed this out to me yesterday. This is Mr. Peter Bone, who is, you could describe him as somebody who just puts in private members' bills of all kinds. Every single year he does this. And he has done this particular one before. This is the Prime Minister Brackett's Temporary Replacement Bill 2017-19. Now, it's a private member's bill. He hasn't published the text. When he's pushed in similar bills in the past, the text has been published, and it's been a bill about making sure that there's contingencies in place if the Prime Minister were to be, you know, temporarily invalided or in hospital for any reason or something like this. But, you know, the question in my mind is, do these people not have anything better to do than to push through private members' bills? They get their first reading in the House. That occupies time in the House of Parliament. It's going to have a second reading this week. So it's either going to get ignored at that point or somebody's going to try to push it forward. But there's time being wasted on this stuff. And you know, there are maybe half a dozen MPs in Parliament that push through this type of private members' bill. And well, what's the point is my question.
Mike, if you look at the overall standard of our MPs, they're arrogance and ignorance, usually in equal measure. Many of them have no idea anymore what reality is. So they attend Westminster, they see something that becomes of importance to them, and then they try and push it through, usually to big themselves up in the eyes of their own constituents. So arrogance, ignorance. We don't have a working parliament at the moment. They don't want a working parliament because, of course, all of the decisions are being made behind these closed doors with charities like the Franco-British Council controlling. I think they would welcome this standard of MP because the more of this type of person that fills Westminster, the more chaotic Parliament will be and the less the public can see of what the true agenda is.
Right, so I'm just going to quote Alex in the chat box there. He said, oddly, the retired number two of GCHQ had a real go at me on Facebook once when I said that private members' bills had often been used as fronts for unpopular government policies. And he's asking, had he hit a raw nerve? Well, that's a good point, because whereas I normally ignore private members' bills as being pointless, perhaps this one is one we need to keep an eye on, because this is the Terms of Withdrawal from the EU, brackets referendum, Bill 2719, and this, sorry, 2017-19, and this is a private member's bill which sets up the possibility of having a referendum at the end of the process for Brexit, when we have an idea what the inverted commas deal is going to be. And so we just need to keep an eye on this one and see whether it does actually make any progress, I think, surreptitiously behind the scenes with no major coverage. And we're going to end with Grenfell Tower. I just wanted to highlight this because the Evening Standard here headline is Grenfell Tower housing boss quits more than 6 months after the tragedy. This is the guy that was responsible for running Grenfell Tower. He was on a £150,000 a year contract. Robert Black is his name. He was the former chief executive of Kensington Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation. He stepped aside from the job in August, but he didn't leave his paid position. Although he wasn't actually operationally doing the job anymore, he continued to receive his full salary. He has now finally stepped down. The reason he said that he needed to stay for that extra 6 months was because he was helping the police investigation and the public inquiry into the fire. I have to say there's a lot of people helping the police investigation and public inquiry into the fire that aren't getting paid on a pro rata basis £150,000 a year. So I just think that is just another insult to the people affected by Grenfell Tower.
Indeed, and perhaps we'll just mention that by extraordinary coincidence in the last few days, there's been a bad fire at the site of the factory that produced, or the firm which produced, the cladding for Grenfell Tower. So extraordinary coincidence, another fire in the very company that produced the cladding. So presumably all sorts of documents will have been burnt, possibly, Mike.
Yes.
Yeah, but there we are. That's the way these coincidences happen. Well, we'll end by saying that we do believe today's news has been one of the most important that we've ever put out. If you can see and understand the way that the government is doing its business behind closed doors with the British Franco charity, then you will be able to see this style of government operating in other sectors, particularly the NHS. But of course, this particular issue relates to defence. And if we lose control over our own military and defence system, procurement system, if that is under the control of the French, it is under the control of the EU, we no longer exist as a nation state. So we'd encourage our viewers and listeners today to help promulgate this information. It's so important that as many people as possible spread it by as many avenues as possible, because it's quite clear that the British government is now clamping down on free speech. And it has to do that, of course, as people expose the duplicity of Theresa May's Conservative government. I'll end on the final point that I'm doing an interview with Caroline Stevens, and hopefully David Ellis will be joining as well, on Daily Brexit. I'll put some details out via my Twitter, so that will appear on the UK column. If you go and look for the Twitter feed on UK column, probably an hour after today's news, you'll be able to see more details of that discussion tonight. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.